epidemiologists, we often describe ourselves as disease detectives. We go into a situation, we gather data, we do interviews, we collect samples, and we put together all these clues and try to unravel the mystery or the puzzle of what it is that's going on. And so much of that is resonant with your descriptions of what happens in a UFO investigation.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia and a bunker below ground, welcome one and all to the Micah Hanks program as we go careening off through space and time in pursuit of the enigmatic, like we do every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com, our corner we occupy here in this darkest corner of the web. And admittedly, over the last few days, things have been a little darker than usual. And in light of that, we've got a lot to cover, so let's lock in. While many of us actually are on lockdown, these are indeed interesting times we are living in. But in this era of social distancing, it's important not to lose our sense of community. So I am glad to have all of you here. And in addition to some news and a few views from you guys out there, we are truly blessed tonight to be joined by a true expert. In fact, many refer to this gentleman as a giant in epidemiology, Dr. Thomas Glass, PhD, a fellow who's been on my radar for quite a while due to our mutual interests, and we're going to touch on that a little in addition to his academic professional interest, which of course has to do with the very kinds of things we're all seeing in the news right now with relation to concerns about this coronavirus pandemic. Now, let me say right here at the outset, my intention, I made up my mind weeks ago that with all of this news, which I have been following very closely, and anyone who follows me on Twitter, at Micah Hanks, saw me being more vocal probably than usual about current events on Twitter over the weekend. Hey, we're all stuck at home. We all have a little time on our hands. But while there is a coronavirus task force in Washington, and many health professionals are absolutely monitoring this situation 24/7, I've got to tell you, I've been doing essentially the same thing here, coordinating with members of the academic community, health professionals, talking with friends and family. That is so very important in times like these. The very first thing we should all do probably is communicate with your loved ones. And no matter how bad things may or may not get, my attitude is always this. Plan for the worst, even if that doesn't happen, even if that's unlikely, but you want to have a plan nonetheless. And things are already a lot worse, unfortunately, than I think many Americans especially had ever perceived. And around the world, as we see the global scale of the current coronavirus pandemic, I think it's really opening a lot of people's eyes. And so we're going to take an extremely critical look at reality, to borrow the words of Richard Oakley in our intro each week. Yeah, we're going to look at some real reality tonight. But with all that said, I'd already made up my mind weeks ago that my intention is not to inundate my listenership with information about the coronavirus. We did a pretty significant update last week. And initially, I'd thought, apart from any real breaking news, we would just shift gears and move on this week. But the reason I decided not to do that, and instead to actually devote an entire show to this topic before we move on, is simply this. Some of the information that I put out on the show last week offered views and opinions from professionals that I don't necessarily agree with any longer in relation to the evolving situation that we are all seeing playing out. And I'm also not advocating panic. I think right here at the outset, it warrants saying that, look, as humans, we always get past problems like this. And as a guy who loves history, you all know how much I love history. If we look back at one of the most severe pandemics in all of history that this is being compared to, the 1918 Spanish flu, yeah, that was really bad, but we got past it. In the 1960s, a similar flu strain struck. We got past it. In 2009, we had an H1N1 strain, and we got past it. In the words of Dr. Ian Malcolm, life finds a way. And here again, humanity will prevail. I promise you that much. And in fact, it may not get as bad as many of the dire forecasts that we're seeing. But yet again, like I'm telling you, call your family members, have a plan. Things may not get that bad at all, but it's best to have that plan, isn't it? Well, I felt that in light of some of the professionals I've been talking with, including our guest later in the program, Dr. Glass, who again is a guy, you hear that expression, that person is way out of my league. Yeah, Dr. Glass, again, with a background, he is a former professor at Yale, Harvard, Johns Hopkins University. He has been a consultant to government on epidemiological issues. You don't get any more way out of my league than that. And yet, Dr. Glass has been gracious enough not only to reach out to me and agree to come on this show, but also has said, and by the way, your interest in the UFO subject fascinates me, and as a retired professor, I'd like to lend my perspective from that of an epidemiologist toward the UFO topic. In fact, he actually recommended that tonight we actually begin right there. So this is going to be a great conversation. Really looking forward to getting into that with him. But before we do all that, let's look at a little that's going on in the news right now. Up off of the coast of Canada, something really, really exciting was recently discovered. Apparently off the coast of Baffin Island, which is actually between the Canadian mainland and Greenland, there are scientists who now say that they have uncovered a splintered remnant of an ancient lost continent. Now, Science Alert reports on this discovery. They note that Baffin Island, located in between the Canadian mainland and Greenland, is a vast Arctic expanse covering about 500,000 square kilometers, making it the fifth largest island in the world. And while it comprises part of the newest recognized territory in Canada, which is called Nunavut, which, as Peter Dockrill notes, writing for Science Alert here, was actually formally established back in 1999, a new discovery shows that this ancient landmass has undisclosed ties that stretch backward in time so far they actually emanate from a distant geological eon. You know, the Earth a long time ago looked a whole lot different than the one that we know today. And things have definitely changed a lot over the ages. And we hear about Pangaea and the idea of a supercontinent in the ancient world, but I mean, there are land masses that were once above water that have come and gone. And again, it's our exploration of the oceans and of geological formations that continue to show us what aspects of this ancient world looked like. And that's kind of what's going on here. As they note here, while analyzing igneous rock samples recovered from diamond exploration drilling, and these were apparently being undertaken on the southern extremes of Baffin Island, they say researchers identified a mineral signature in the rock that they had never expected to find. These are called kimberlites. And I'm sure my good pal James Waldo, geologist extraordinaire, knows all about kimberlites, which they liken here not to rocks, but rockets. That's right. According to Maya Kopalova of the University of British Columbia, she says that the kimberlites in question are subterranean rocks that pick up passengers, so to speak, on their way up to the surface. Those passengers, by the way, are solid chunks of wall rocks that carry a wealth of details on conditions far beneath the surface of our planet over time. And hence, we're able to observe what that ancient portion of the planet looked like. So yes, we are talking about an ancient continent, a lost land, so to speak. But no, not a lost civilization. In fact, this was well before the thing that we call civilization ever existed. Talk about isolation, huh? But in spite of all the isolation I think a lot of people right now are probably feeling, the Huffington Post had an article recently talking about how astronauts are giving advice on isolation in this era of social distancing. Yeah, that's right. And according to Josephine Harvey, in light of the coronavirus pandemic, space explorers, many of whom have spent months living in otherworldly isolation, are sharing their guidance on how to get by while living in confinement, something many people around the world are adapting to in a bid to limit the spread of the outbreak. According to astronaut Scott Kelly, he says, being stuck at home can be challenging. When I lived on the International Space Station for nearly a year, it wasn't easy. When I went to sleep, I was at work. When I woke up, I was still at work. Wow. Actually, I think I can relate, Scott Kelly. That sounds an awful lot like me. He went on to say that flying in space is probably the only job you absolutely cannot quit. In other words, once you get there, you're stuck there. And that's how a lot of us feel right now. And so what do you do with your time if you're stuck at home, as so many are right now? Most of us, in fact. Well, you could always pretend that you're Scott Kelly, which will, I'm sure, give you an all-new appreciation for the jobs performed by our astronauts, and yes, the isolation that ensues. But as many of us in America and around the world are now experiencing isolation, the likes of which we maybe haven't felt in quite a while, except for those of us who work from home, you know, this really is a good time to be looking at family. This is a good time to be looking at the things that we often procrastinate and don't do because we can't find the time, and perhaps actually do them. And yes, even if we are social distancing, we have to try and remain in touch. We have to maintain that sense of community. And this is one reason I am thankful for social media and also electronic communication in other forms, which brings us to a few listener emails. Tom actually wrote to me with a UFO sighting. And here again, in an effort not to completely inundate my listenership, although we're going to talk a good bit about the coronavirus tonight, we're also going to talk about UFOs. We're not going to forget about our interests and the things that we all mutually enjoy. And so Tom writes to me, I live in Green Bay, Wisconsin. At approximately 8:25 p.m. on March 21st, my wife and I walked outside heading for the garage. We were outside under clear skies, walking toward the south and the constellation of Orion right up above the garage. I stopped to point out to her Betelgeuse and to fill her in on the recent variances in its brightness and the possibility of it going nova when my wife said, oh, look, a satellite. And there was a dim, single little spot of light that was moving quickly from right to left, just to the left and below Betelgeuse. We both said, cool. And as I returned to the story about Betelgeuse, I saw another satellite. Same size, same speed, same brightness, and following the other's path exactly. Now, we could see both, one following the other at about 10 degrees apart. I said, wow, that's weird. And then my wife said, there's another one. Well, just to the right and below Betelgeuse was a third satellite. Again, same size, brightness, speed, and path. We stood there for several minutes and eventually saw six evenly spaced objects cross through Orion just below Betelgeuse. By the time the last two objects appeared, we were watching for them, as we had seen four already and were expecting them. They seemed to appear just to the right of Aldebaran, he notes here he had to look that one up, and just below as if they had begun to catch the sun's rays. There were only the six. I've never seen a string of satellites like that before in my 40 years of skygazing. A quick look at satellite tracking sites didn't help me identify what we saw. My wife was shook up about it. We've often been out at night around a campfire and watched satellites cross the sky and observe meteor showers. Seeing six evenly spaced objects appear in the same spot in the sky and follow the same path, not so much. Any ideas? Thanks, man, Tom. Well, Tom, of course, thank you for taking time to write, although, again, like so many of us, you may have more time on your hands depending on your profession and what the conditions are in your neck of the woods. I hope it's good. I hope it's manageable, at least. I know so many right now are being affected in light of this coronavirus, but I do want to offer at least what I think is a bit of an explanation, possibly, for what you saw. Because, in fact, we had received a similar email from a pilot some time ago who described seeing something that was very similar to how you described that string of satellites, Tom, and I actually think that's exactly what that was. I think that this was what's called the Starlink, which is a satellite constellation, as they're known, being constructed by the American company SpaceX. And the idea is that this Starlink constellation is going to eventually consist of thousands of mass-produced small satellites in low Earth orbit, which are aimed at providing internet access. But according to the Wikipedia page for Starlink, the Starlink constellation Phase 1 consists of a first orbital shell of 72 orbits with 22 components each for a total of 1,584 satellites at a 550-kilometer altitude. The maiden launch for this occurred on February 22nd of 2018, the last one actually on the 17th of February this year. And so many people have reported seeing what appear to be strings of satellites all moving in the same direction and roughly equidistant from one another in space. I can't say with certainty, but it's very possible that something along the lines of the Starlink satellite array is indeed what you observed. And so I definitely thank you for sending along a UFO report, even in the midst of these very trying times. I encourage the rest of you guys to keep your eyes on the skies in the evenings as well. Info@MicahHanks.com is how to send along your own emails. And when we come back, we're going to turn our attention to issues at hand with the coronavirus. Dr. Thomas Glass will be our guest right here on the Micah Hanks program. I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome back. So it goes without saying, these are some strange and concerning times that we are living in right now. And of course, I always try to maintain a hopeful outlook. And that, of course, is going to be, I hope, the resounding takeaway from this week's show, because life does go on, but it helps at times like this to be well-informed. And so to help us become more well-informed, I couldn't imagine a better guest to join us than our guest tonight, Dr. Thomas Glass, PhD. He is a former professor at Harvard, at Yale, and at Johns Hopkins University, and also a former advisor to government on issues pertaining to epidemiology. He has a website right now, which is currently monitoring the situation with the coronavirus. We will give that website address out a little later, but first I want to welcome him to the program. Dr. Thomas Glass, thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, you're most welcome, Micah. It's great to be able to talk to you. I've been listening to you for a long time. I'm a big fan, and I'm so delighted that our mutual interests have brought us together today. How are things in the bunker? I trust you have some good, strong black coffee with you?
Yes, you know me all too well already. Indeed, I have Sumatran coffee. It is black. It's in my Keep Calm and Time Travel mug, and that's what I intend to do. And, you know, you are further north than I am. You are not in New York City. We'll keep your location undisclosed for the time being, but it's incumbent upon me to ask you how you're doing as well, considering that the northeastern United States have currently become an epicenter in this coronavirus outbreak.
Well, I'm doing fine. Thanks for asking, Micah. We have definitely woken up into a world in which things are different. There's a new reality out there, and that is certainly true outside my doors. It is outside yours. But people are managing, despite all the talk of social distancing, which people are doing at the same time, there are kids in the streets. There are people talking, across their yards. People are coping. They're managing. Things are uncertain, but I think spirits are fairly high around here. We definitely see the impact. A lot less traffic. Some shelves are bare at the stores, things are going along as normal as they can be in what is now a brand new world.
Yeah. And I think that that's the important point to drive home as we get into that conversation from the epidemiological angle, you know, how our lives are changing, the kinds of things people should be aware of, but of course, the fundamental things that we can also do to make this process, as this ever-evolving situation continues, a little less troublesome. And I definitely think that it's times like this that we remember, hey, you know, we're all in this together, something that you have continued to reiterate at your website. And we're going to put that information out for folks a little later too, because at your website, you have been doing daily briefings. And when I actually reached out to you the other day, I had said, would you be willing to talk with me about this? And very graciously, you said, not only yes, I'll take any opportunity, but you said, I think I have something to offer on this. Well, I think, yeah, that is an understatement. You are one of the most qualified, you know, professionals in this field that I personally know. And from the looks of the information going up daily on your website, it's very important that that information get out. Although I want to also point out, and as you had even advised me, we talked on the telephone before we ever got behind the microphone, so to speak, for this week's show. And you'd said, let's also talk about our mutual interest, that being ufology. That's why you initially reached out to me, and I was so interested when the email came to my inbox from a retired professor of epidemiology with your kind of background, you know, and the incredible experience that you draw from being an educator. You're saying, I have some unique ideas about the UFO phenomenon as it relates to the epidemiological perspective. So can we start right there? You'd even made that sort of connection with the topic we discussed a few weeks ago with Colares, Brazil, and had said a lot of what we see with a UFO flap that breaks out like that is similar to how epidemiologists begin to observe patterns with an outbreak.
Yeah, indeed. I have this feeling frequently when I listen to your program, Micah, that, just listening to you talk about what happened in Brazil in the 1970s, It sounded so much like what we do in epidemiology when we investigate an outbreak. And you even use the word breakout to describe the UFO flap, as you say, in Brazil. And as I was listening, I had a almost deja vu kind of feeling, because so many of the challenges that we face in investigating a disease outbreak are similar to what arises in the context of investigating a UFO phenomenon. And just listening to you talk about it, like, for example, in epidemiology, one of the first things we have to try to do is to define the limits and parameters of the disease that we're investigating. We call it case definition, and we see this in COVID-19, confusion about exactly what constitutes a case. And in the case of the Brazilian outbreak, you could call it, you interviewed or played the interview audio from those who had investigated and talked to physicians who saw burns on the skin and pinholes and symptoms such as, you know, malaise, memory loss, all kinds of different things.
Right.
This is exactly what we do in an outbreak investigation. You talked about hotspots, particular areas where sightings were more common. You talked about the role of scapegoating, where groups become, you know, conflict arises between groups about whose fault things are, the presence of rumors and how rumors spread in a kind of viral way when there's a UFO outbreak. So there are a lot of similarities. And epidemiologists, we all often describe ourselves as disease detectives. We go into a situation, we gather data, we do interviews, we collect samples, we look at the physical consequences of the disease, and we put together all these clues and try to unravel the mystery or the puzzle of what it is that's going on. And so much of that is resonant with your descriptions of what happens in a UFO investigation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and fundamentally, I would say that if there is a similarity, really, between the way that the epidemiological perspective and the UFO studies perspective are similar, it is the idea that I think that with UFOs, as much as with a virus outbreak or anything else that science can be applied to, I feel that there is a physical phenomena worthy of study when we're talking about UFOs, and therefore the same sorts of procedures and applications that are present in other scientific disciplines in many ways can and should be applied to it. What's really interesting, though, is from the social science perspective, the ways that attitudes, biases, human perception, stigmas, the limitations of knowledge, you know, perception, all these kinds of things play into both of these situations. And here in a moment, that'll be a good way to kind of maybe transition over into discussing the current pandemic. But with relation to UFO reports, we find people describe seeing an object or they have an experience. Sometimes, as we saw with Kolaris in Brazil, there's a physical effect that the experience has on some of those who witness it. And as a result of that, when medical professionals become involved, we are looking at, and of course, there was Dr. Carvalho, who in the Kolaris investigation, she was involved, and we mentioned her research because she was one of the key officials who had been involved on the ground, so to speak, observing characteristics, you know, burns, different kinds of symptoms, we might say, and trying to understand what is the physical cause behind this. And it was perplexing for her in terms of trying to understand, okay, what are we dealing with? Is this something that is communicable? Is there another explanation for what these people are experiencing? Or do we have to take them, you know, in terms of what they're telling me is true, accurate, and authentic? Now, we apply that, for instance, to the outbreak in China early on when this first erupts. One of the issues that many reports are indicating is that people weren't sure exactly what we were dealing with, whether this was a new kind of illness at all.
Well, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, One of the things that makes investigating UFOs and epidemics so similar is that at the heart of it is a real uncertainty about what is going on. And in the case of the initial outbreak in Wuhan province in China, it took a long time for clinicians and officials and the general public to get their hands around the fact that there seemed to be an epidemic that was starting to unfold, but no one knew exactly what was the nature of that epidemic or what the pathogen was. And so that sense of uncertainty about what the physical reality was initially parallels what happens when there is a unexplained phenomenon. All, you know, all novel pathogens, when they explode in a population, are in a sense unidentified viral objects, UVOs, if you will.
Yeah.
And that uncertainty about whether this is something new or something that we're familiar with, that's one of the main challenges of trying to figure out how to stop an epidemic, which you can't do until you figure out the nature of the pathogen involved.
That's right. Identify the problem first. Now, unlike UFOs, and I appreciate you actually proposing that we start there, you know, talking about the mutual interest, because I think that that kind of gives people a way that they can relate to this. Interestingly, even at this stage with this coronavirus situation, now a global issue, and with, I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are being affected by this, there are still so many questions about, well, what are the symptoms? You know, what is the long-term effect of this going to be on us? I think a lot of people in many ways, especially in communities that have not yet been affected tremendously by this, and maybe the worst thing that they're seeing is a lack of toilet paper on the shelves. I mean, for a lot of people, there's still sort of this disconnect. What is all of the hubbub about? Why are people so concerned? Before long, I feel like we're going to be able to identify this issue. More people are going to be able to relate to it, but also scientists and medical professionals are going to understand the nature of the problem we're dealing with, unlike, very unlike, UFOs, where so many questions have persisted over such a great amount of time. So let's kind of start there, Dr. Glass. Maybe we can talk a little about, with all 50 U.S. states here in the United States now being affected, and this truly being global in scale, where do things currently stand with the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, yes. And, you know, I'm not here selling fear,
right,
Micah. And so we want to approach things from the standpoint of facts and data. And we want to tell the true story about what's going on. But we don't want people to be paralyzed by fear. And at this point, there is certainly reason for concern, and people need to be monitoring things. And we need to get busy as an entire society to confront what is essentially a once in a lifetime or once in a generation challenge. We do indeed have a pandemic of a brand new novel viral pathogen. This is an organism that has made the jump from animals to people some point in the fall of 2019. And a cycle of epidemic transmission began in China that is now spreading around the globe and has the potential to impact all corners. As I look now at my at the dashboard at the Johns Hopkins Center for Systems Science and Engineering, which is a site I use to track the virus, we stand at 357 global cases and 116,013 deaths at this point. One of the things to think about is that while this initially, the outbreak initially began as a provincial matter in Wuhan, China, there is nothing to prevent this epidemic from spreading globally and in a very rapid fashion as a result of the fact that we have this strange combination of a novel pathogen that is good at transmitting itself, as well as global travel and interaction that makes for unprecedented ease for a virus like this to become global in scope. And that's what's happened. One thing to keep in mind is that every point on the map that we see the outbreak occur really constitutes the same underlying population dynamic process that is occurring and has occurred in places like China and Italy. The only difference is where in the time course each location is. So the same underlying processes of spread and dissemination are occurring in places like Italy, Spain, Germany, the United States, that took place in China, and the same processes or the same outbreak control procedures that we need to put in place are required in all of these places. In other words, at some point in a global pandemic with a brand new virus that no one has immunity to, everyone's going to be affected, and we are, globally speaking, all in this together.
Absolutely, which is maybe, you know, one of the key points not only to drive home, but also one of the things that is on the hopeful side of things. We, like you said, we don't want people panicking. We don't want people to be overtly concerned, but we need to be very realistic about the concern. And part of the issue, actually, part of what is so concerning is, as you have pointed out to me during our correspondence, Thomas, the fact that many people who are affected by this, and by that I mean infected with the coronavirus, they have only mild effects. They may have actually very few, if any, symptoms. The fact that there are some carriers who are not very badly affected by this makes it all the more dangerous. Can you talk a little about that? Because many people are saying, look at how well we've managed Ebola in the past. I've said this. Ebola is a really scary disease. Some people with coronavirus, if they get a tickle in the throat and a cough, that's about it. Why does that make this actually more of a concern?
Right. So everyone is afraid of Ebola. Ebola is the viral boogeyman that we all know about, and for good reason. But here's the strange part, Micah. It turns out that if you're thinking about how do we control an epidemic, how do we prevent an epidemic from going global and killing millions, it turns out that that's easier to do with a disease like Ebola, because Ebola is so easy to identify, detect, and isolate. In other words, a disease that kills almost everyone it touches, and the mortality rate for Ebola is around 50%, about half of all those who get it, who contract Ebola die. But with this disease, because up to 80% of the people who are infected have either no symptoms or mild symptoms, and because this virus has developed the ability to transmit itself from people who have mild symptoms or no symptoms, we are looking at an organism that is much more efficient and effective at spreading itself, because it's so difficult to actually control a disease that can be spread by people who are otherwise healthy. So this epidemic is being driven by and has moved so rapidly precisely because it kills such a small fraction of the population. The epidemic is not being driven by people who are sick and bedridden or in a hospital. It's being driven by what we call covert cases. About half of all people who are infected will have little or no symptoms, and they are capable of transmitting it. And this is why the epidemic has raged so dramatically and rapidly, as we've seen.
Yes, I'm so glad you point that out, by the way. And when we come back after this, I want to get into some discussion, not only about the actual symptoms that we're beginning to see, but also Let's talk a little about the origins of this virus. My guest is Dr. Thomas Glass, PhD. He is an epidemiologist, and he is giving us unique perspectives on the coronavirus, which we will continue when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. Glad as always to be your host. I am Micah Hanks. I'm broadcasting to you live 7 to 9 East Coast time via KGRARadio.com. This week, certainly a special discussion, since with all of the concern right now over what we are hearing about in the news with the coronavirus, we are blessed enough, I think, to have a guest joining us who offers not only a perspective on this from his professional background, but someone who has long followed, with a very serious academic approach, many of the other kinds of things that we discuss on this show. And of course, being an epidemiologist who writes to me and says, again, this was many months ago when this occurred, but writing to me and introducing himself and saying, I am, like you, following a lot of the developments in the UFO community. Would you ever like to get the perspective of an epidemiologist on this topic? And so I was certainly very interested, but who would have thought, after being able to correspond with Dr. Glass for a number of months now, that we would find ourselves in a situation where his professional work would be so relevant. And so again, I'm so glad to have him here with us tonight. And now, I would like to get into discussing some of the symptoms with you in a moment. But first, as we are kind of illustrating what we're dealing with, and we're trying to understand the origins, essentially, of an outbreak like this, very briefly, maybe we could at very least talk not so much about the actual origins of this virus. We know, of course, that this pandemic emerged in Wuhan, China, but we perhaps maybe should look at also how a coronavirus emerges into human populations. Can we talk just a little about that, how this actually begins?
Sure. So there are dozens and dozens of different versions of coronaviruses that circulate in animals of many species. Of all those versions or separate genetically distinct types of coronaviruses, there are seven that we know that have made the jump from an animal host to having the capability of being transmitted to humans and then being transmittable human to human, generally through exposure to respiratory droplets. So we've got seven different coronaviruses, or until last fall, we had six that we knew about. And at some point, a version of coronavirus that has its, we believe its natural host is a type of bat. At some point, that virus underwent some series of mutations in its genetic code that allowed it to develop the capacity to jump into humans and to be transmitted from human to human. The process of how that happens is complicated and not well understood, but it did happen. It's in somewhere in China, and the epidemic began in earnest. Now, one of the things about viruses that's important to understand is that viruses are very good at adapting to all of the things we try to do to defeat them. And they do this by process of random mutation in their genetic sequences. And these random mutations, usually when they occur, and they are constantly occurring, generally speaking, don't generate new levels of pathogenicity. But in this instance, we have a brand new version of coronavirus that is not recognized by the immune system of inhabitants of this planet. And therefore, we have limited defenses, limited ability to recognize the virus and mount a defense. And that's why novel viruses like this can become so impactful.
Right. You know, we've talked a little about this, the fact that the scientist back in 2015 had an article, and I mentioned this on the show last week, and I also want to offer really quickly here that a lot of my own perspectives on the current pandemic have changed since last week, you know, with a lot of the reporting I've done, taking actually at times a fairly dismissive attitude. It's not that I don't recognize a threat, but of course, I always want people to take things in stride. But while I think that this is obviously a situation, I would hope that you would agree that it's manageable and that if everybody does their part, you know, this isn't going to get out of hand. I'm taking the situation, I think I've always taken it seriously, but I'm looking at it in a very different way now. And that is in part from talking with you. And fundamentally, last week on the show, I did mention this article from 2015, which discussed a lab strain of coronavirus that was being studied in 2015. Of course, the idea here is not that this was born in a lab. And as I pointed out at that time, they were actually studying this in a laboratory at Chapel Hill here in North Carolina for purpose of trying to understand how a coronavirus might leave a bat, and then if whether or not it actually has to go to a carrier species, to a intermediary that carries it to humans. This is how we believe that this coronavirus strain currently in 2020 emerged into human populations. But many people have looked at that article, Thomas, and said, well, look, this was cooked up in a laboratory. How do we know that the current one wasn't? Now, of course, you flatly refute that. Tell us why, indeed, it is almost impossible. It's a certainty that this current lab, this current strain, it has nothing to do with a laboratory, as some have suggested.
Right. I've certainly heard the rumors that that this has somehow been an engineered virus that escaped from a lab somewhere or was brought from one lab to another. These kinds of rumors are, you know, are to be expected. And, you know, if you look at the history of epidemics, these kinds of rumors always arise. In fact, the great Spanish flu epidemic of 1918, throughout most of the world, World War I was going on. Throughout most of the world, there was a very entrenched belief that the organism that caused that horrific pandemic was developed by the Germans, and that they were infecting the world by putting it in aspirin, Bayer aspirin, Bayer being a German company that predates World War I. So that belief was very, very much entrenched.
Wow.
The fact that we, indeed, it's true that we do have very specialized, a very small number of very specialized laboratories that work with very dangerous pathogens and tinker with them in as far as we try to understand better the properties that make viruses dangerous. And that research is done under very controlled and specific conditions. And the important thing to realize is that the fact that researchers are able to modify genetically a particular gene or modify the expression of a given protein, that does not mean that there's any evidence or reason to believe that that kind of tinkering is what caused this outbreak or is responsible for this particular organism. The bottom line, Mike, is that Mother Nature is much better at molecular biology than we are. The genetic changes that are required for a virus to leap from bats to an intermediate to humans involves changes in multiple genes at multiple sites in order for this to happen. And we don't have the ability to do that kind of manipulation. Besides, if somehow somebody were to tinker with a gene in a way that, you know, everybody has to be on the record when they do this kind of research as to what it is they're doing. So if somehow someone had, in fact, modified the genes in a virus that then escaped, there would be a very clear smoking gun that would make it very easy to figure out who had done it and how. But tinkering with one gene in a laboratory to see how it affects the behavior of an organism is a very is a long way away from being able to change a virus in a way that it has the ability to do what this one is doing.
Right. And, you know, again, many people look at novel coronavirus strain and they're like, where does a disease like this come from? Or rather, I should say a virus. You know, how does something like this just appear out of nowhere? Well, in fact, it has long been expected that this would occur. It was not a matter of if, it was a matter of when, right?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, this is one of those moments, and it happens every once in a while. It happened in 2009 with H1N1. All of, you know, where the work that we do in epidemiology is kind of very much under the radar. Nobody, you know, people are constantly saying, epidemiology, what is that? Does that have to do with the skin or whatever?
Right.
And, but then once in a while, one of these a new epidemic hits the news cycle, and everybody wants to know what epidemiology is. So the truth is that we have known for many years that very dangerous viruses are on a cycle or a periodicity of infectious outbreaks, and that outbreaks like the one we're seeing now are very much within the realm of what we have expected. The fact that we have decades that go by in between these outbreaks is just a consequence of the way viruses work. But viruses are very good at modifying and manipulating and changing over time in ways that cause this, you know, wave-like these cycles of outbreaks. And because we live in a much more connected world than we ever have, the close proximity of human populations to animals, to birds, and to each other, creates more and more opportunities for these kind of outbreaks to occur.
Yeah, that's a really important point, by the way, because, again, according to some of the current figures, I mean, a lot of people are saying this is going to be pretty severe. And we've seen, of course, already comparisons to the Spanish flu. And I like, by the way, that you'd mentioned to me the other day on the telephone when we spoke about this, you'd said, you know, at Yale and Harvard and Johns Hopkins, you know, you were always known as the history guy. You've always said to people, know the history of these kinds of outbreaks. That helps us understand what may be happening right now. One thing that I guess has changed since 1918 would be the fact that we have a lot more people here on planet Earth, don't we?
We do indeed, and we are more interconnected. One of the reasons that the influenza strain that caused the epidemic of 1918 spread so dramatically is, as I mentioned, World War I was going on, so you had troops and supplies and a greater level of connectedness and travel going on at that particular moment, all of which provided kind of a super highway for the virus to spread. I just might note as a little footnote that people call it the Spanish flu, which is to almost imply that that particular pandemic started in Spain, which is absolutely not true. It's most likely that the Spanish flu epidemic started in Kansas. But it's called the Spanish flu because during World War I, the Allied nations essentially all agreed that no one in the press or media would mention the epidemic for fear that it would harm the war effort. The only place where public news stories about the emerging epidemic were being published was in Spain, because Spain was a neutral party in the war. And as a result, the only thing we knew about the epidemic was coming from Spanish news outlets. And therefore, the disease was labeled Spanish influenza, even though Spain was in no way the source of it. So that illustrates how very often the communication about the what's going on with an epidemic lags behind the reality. And that's very much what we see in the case of COVID-19, where at any one moment, our understanding of where we are is a few steps behind where the epidemic is.
Right. Yeah. One more reason I think, though, that it's so important for us to study history, to know the history, so that we can apply that to today, and that may help us to form models and to be generally more well-informed as we proceed with trying to, you know, counteract the effects of this global pandemic. And ladies and gents, at this point, if it is not already evident to you, this is in our backyards, so to speak. In fact, I think it's safe to say it's in our front yards, but we need to look at things sensibly and accept that things are changing, but you know what? We're going to get past it. And also, fundamentally, this is going to be something that will be with us for a time. We're just going to learn to address it in the most informed way that we can, which we seek to do with Dr. Glass when we return tonight here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program, continuing our discussion with Dr. Thomas Glass. And I do want to remind you, of course, he has a website with a lot of relevant information about the current pandemic. He's analyzing this, again, with an epidemiological background, unlike most. Having been formerly a professor at Harvard, at Yale, at Johns Hopkins, he's been an advisor to government on this issue. We are so blessed to be able to have him joining us tonight and answering questions about this situation as it unfolds. And so I really want to get into talking a little about the symptoms because, you know, Thomas, a question I have had about this has to do with the fact that with all of the cases and with all of the data that is being collected about this by health professionals, there still seems to be a little disconnect in terms of what the actual symptoms are. As we've already touched on, one reason for that would be that this is a virus that affects different people differently, different age groups, different people in different portions of the population. The symptoms aren't always the same, but what kinds of symptoms are we looking at that you have found to be common in the various different manifestations of the COVID-19 virus strain?
Right. The whole symptom thing, that is quite a challenge, Micah. And, you know, one of the first orders of business in an outbreak investigation is to define exactly what constitutes a case. And that's always a challenge, especially with a virus, because a respiratory virus, the symptoms that we see, like fever, cough, myalgia, which is muscle aches and pains, the symptoms are actually caused not by the virus itself, but by our body's response to the invasion of the virus. So a fever is our body's way of trying to cook the virus to death, essentially. Raising body temperature causes the environment in the body to be less favorable to the organism. So the fever is our body's attempt to fight against the presence of a virus. And everybody... People respond to viral infections differently. And as a result, the symptoms that arise end up being inconsistent and hard to define. Therefore, it's really impossible to come up with a set of clinical symptoms that is really good at differentiating the coronavirus from common colds or regular old seasonal flu. The truth is that the majority of people who get what we refer to as a common cold, actually, many of them are actually getting a different form of coronavirus. So the symptoms are, it's very tricky to come up with a list of symptoms.
Right.
The way this emerged is that when the virus was first being characterized in China, we had small studies of small groups of patients in the hospital, and we looked at their symptoms and we said, what symptoms are common that can be used to define a case more broadly. One of the first studies that we did was a study in Wuhan of 138 patients. In that study, they found that fever, cough, and shortness of breath were the three main symptoms. Now, since that time, now we're up to 367,000 total cases. We've got a lot more information.
Right.
And as new studies have come out, it turns out that that particular study probably wasn't telling us the whole story. For example, shortness of breath, which was one of the main symptoms identified in that first study, turns out to be present in only about a third of cases. It turns out that fatigue is a more indicative symptom of the disease based on new information coming out of the WHO and some larger studies of bigger groups. So the top symptoms that I have found in looking at all these studies include fever, dry cough, fatigue, coughing up phlegm, body aches and pains, shortness of breath, and then there are a series of other symptoms that are occurring, oh, maybe 10-15% of the time, including sore throat, headache, dizziness, and runny nose. So we are still in a situation where the best way to figure out who has the disease is through testing. And the whole question about testing is a discussion in and of itself. But the symptoms that we're seeing are more varied and more diverse than we believed at first. And this is important, Micah, because the truth is that a lot of people out there, they may have a slight cough. They may have a very low grade fever. After all, what is a fever anyway? I don't even think we're entirely clear on that. And they say, well, I probably have a cold. It doesn't sound like COVID to me. Well, a sizable fraction of those people actually do have COVID. They don't know it. They don't recognize it as COVID. And they're out potentially transmitting it to others.
Yes, that is one of the most important points, I think, that could be made about this, since it seems so counterintuitive that those who are the healthiest and coping the best against this virus might actually be helping the most with its spread. We're talking with Dr. Thomas Glass, and we will continue this conversation with him about the coronavirus when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program, broadcasting via KGRARadio.com to the four corners of the globe and available listen on demand via podcast apps everywhere. Very special program tonight. Our very special guest, Dr. Thomas Glass. His website again is thomasglassphd.com, and he is providing daily updates as this coronavirus pandemic situation unfolds. And hence, it is all the more important that we all stay informed. And again, I hope that this is a very hopeful message. We're going to get through this, and many will not be affected all that badly. Others, it's going to be a different story. But that is why it is all the more important for us to be able to rally together And remember to maintain that sense of community, which is so important in times of social distancing like this. Do also, of course, remember, if you are stuck at home, you can't leave the house. If you are a subscriber to this program, of course, if you are an ex-subscriber, we've got the same ex-podcasts, the Enigmas specials and everything going out to subscribers. And of course, all the free podcasts are still available there too at MicahHanks.com. Whatever level of involvement you have, subscriber, or if you're just a casual listener who picks up every other episode or so, we have something for you. All that can be found there at MicahHanks.com. And I really like to say this at least once per show, but I have to reiterate during times like these how much it means to me that those of you out there who are subscribers and supporters of this show, how much you guys mean to me when you continue to show that support. Again, we here are a community, and we get through things like this together by maintaining that sense of community and looking out for our loved ones. So we look out for each other. I want to hear from you as well. info@MicahHanks.com. If you've got a story, if you'd like to email me, you can also tweet at me at MicahHanks on Twitter. Now, with that, we'll get right back into things here. Dr. Glass, as we're picking up in this hour, I want a bit of clarification from you about the difference in terminology. Again, there is a difference between the virus and then the actual disease that manifests. Let's talk a little about that difference.
Yeah, for sure. This is a respiratory virus. The name of the virus at the moment is SARS-CoV-2. That's the name of the virus. And the disease that it causes is now referred to as COVID-19.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. So there's the disconnect again. The manifestation as it results in human populations is disease. The actual virus strain, which has a different name, is a different thing. I presume a lot of this information, of course, is going to be found online. But at this point, I also want to give you an opportunity before we proceed to mention your website, because you're doing daily updates, briefings there at your website. That's Thomas Glass, PhD, all one word, .com, correct?
Yeah. I am retired as a professor of epidemiology, so I've got time on my hands. I've been interested and curious about what's going on since the very beginning, and I started getting questions from family members and friends and people I play hockey with, and they were all saying, "Hey, what's going on? What's going on?" And because I was tracking it, I started to send out emails telling people like my daily take on what are the most important stories. And that kind of morphed into this idea of a website. And I've tried to put together, a one-stop shopping opportunity for people to gather information, to see useful tools, to get definitions of things. And I try to pick, for example, one news article that's particularly important. And I try to basically summarize in a page or so the most important news and information and research that is out there on a given day to try to help myself and other people sort of keep up with this crazy pace of daily change.
Yeah, I mean, it is changing. It is a quickly evolving situation, although the more data that we gather, the better equipped to be able to combat this we will be. And that's something that I like about your website. You keep saying, look, guys, the reality is this is here. It is here to stay. I mean, people are going to be building up immunity to it. There will be eventually a vaccine for this, and we'll touch on that in a moment also. But the reality is that we're going to have to deal with this coronavirus strain henceforth into the future, and therefore we are literally all in this together. But again, maybe that's not necessarily a cause for concern or gloom. I mean, again, it's an opportunity, I think, for us to remember that as team civilization, as I like to call it, you know, we all play a part, and by working together, we will get through this, as we have in every instance in the past when a similar outbreak has occurred.
Yeah, as a researcher, I cut my teeth studying natural and technological disasters early in my career. And one of the things that really impressed me in studying natural disasters, hurricanes and tornadoes and sewer explosions and all kinds of things, one of the things that people always say in the context of natural disasters is it's amazing more people weren't killed.
Yeah.
And what I learned in, you know, in the work I did is that it's not amazing at all. In fact, human beings are designed and have been evolutionarily selected to be highly adaptive. We're very good at surviving in times of calamity. We are incredibly resourceful and resilient, and we tend to work collectively in ways that are rather miraculous in response to emergencies and disasters. And I have no doubt that that the same thing will be seen when history talks about this particular epidemic, that people were resilient, they were proactive, and that they coped and adapted to changing situations in ways that that can now only be imagined.
Absolutely. Yeah, we do, of course, have an incredible ability, we as humans, to adapt and to, well, again, in the words of Dr. Ian Malcolm, as he always said, life finds a way. We do find a way. I do want to ask you, on that subject of, you know, life, many people also look at the other side of that coin, what the mortality rates are associated with this. And again, it's natural for us to kind of gravitate toward the fact that we are dealing with a potentially deadly virus strain. It has resulted in a lot of casualties. Then again, many would also point out that every year, so does the flu. And so let's talk a little about the actual mortality rate as associated with COVID-19. How does it compare to the seasonal flu? And maybe how much cause for concern does that arouse?
Right. Well, that is, I guess, the million-dollar question, right? Indeed, in the very early stages of any outbreak investigation, we are very much focused on trying to identify what we call the case fatality rate, the percentage of people who become infected who will die. This number is very important to put into our models to make predictions about what's going to happen. But practically speaking, it tells us a lot about how we need to prepare for people to be sick and how many casualties we are likely to expect. The problem, of course, in figuring out what the fatality rate is for a given pathogen is that in the very early stages, the only patients that we end up seeing are patients who are very sick and who end up in the hospital. And therefore, because they have a higher risk of dying, we're not taking account of the large number of cases of people with mild symptoms.
Right.
So the estimated fatality rates were inflated, is the right way to put it, I think.
Ah, okay.
Initially in China. So then we get busy doing what we do in epidemiology, and we use models and various kinds of other investigative strategies to try to figure out, okay, what is the real case fatality rate within the population? And while we're getting closer to having the right answer to that question, there's still quite a bit of uncertainty. So like a lot of things, the best answer I could give you about that is a range of possibilities, understanding that we don't currently have enough certainty to say exactly what the case fatality rate is. But I will say here are the two most important takeaways. Number one, we know that the case fatality rate for this disease is probably somewhere between 10 and 30 times higher than the regular seasonal flu. The regular seasonal flu has a case fatality rate of about 0.1%. Sounds like a real low number, but if a large number of people become infected, that leads to anywhere between 30 and 60,000 deaths in the United States a year from the common flu.
Right.
So this disease, the COVID-2 disease, is associated with a case fatality rate that is somewhere between 1 and 3.4%. It actually may be less than 1. It may be 0.5%, 0.8%, somewhere around 0.5% up to about 3.4% is our current upper estimate. However, that case fatality rate varies quite a bit depending on where you look and when you look. So we'll get more information, you know, as the epidemic unfolds. But we are looking at a disease that's going to kill a higher percentage of victims than is true for the common flu. But less has the case fatality rate is definitely going to be lower than, say, MERS, and is probably going to be lower also than was the case for SARS.
Right. Yeah. And again, you know, as we look at this situation and the evolving, you know, aspects of it changing almost on a day-to-day basis, I've been monitoring a lot of these percentages, including, of course, those mortality rates, and we're seeing them go up and down. We're still getting information about this fundamentally, and that is important to remember in all of this. Something else that comes to mind is Italy, because I've seen a lot of reporting on the current coronavirus pandemic kind of centering on Italy because of the effect that the virus has had on that country. I have seen speculations about, well, does this have to do with the elderly population there, the likelihood for intermingling between younger age groups and older age groups in that country? And in our conversations and dialogue, you've kind of asked me what to you seems different about that country. I mean, fundamentally, that's what we're seeing right there on a countrywide basis is what we're going to see happen here and what we've already seen happen elsewhere. So is there some superficial aspect of Italy that, as it's being reported, gives the impression of there just being this surge, this outbreak there that's different somehow from what's happening elsewhere?
Right. So we've seen different profiles in different countries, and the one in Italy is particularly alarming because of the speed and the scope of the outbreak there. And it's tempting to look at Italy and say, oh gosh, there's something special or unique going on there. Look at how the cases and the deaths have surged. At this point, it's too early to say whether or not there's something particular about the outbreak in Italy that is especially severe, or whether the outbreak that is occurring in many countries, including the United States, is exactly the same kind of underlying process, but at just different points in time, in a time scale. So if you were to take the epidemic curve, which is the way that we graphically represent the movement of an epidemic through a population, if you were to take that curve in Italy and superimpose it on, say, the curve that we see in the United States, they look actually quite similar. It's just that Italy is further along in the process of that country metabolizing the epidemic. So right now, when we look at, so where is the United States going? The best place to look is to look at Italy and say, well, what we see in Italy is we have to be prepared for the possibility that that is exactly what we're going to see in the United States. Now, there are a lot of other factors that could change the situation and cause our outbreak to be faster, more severe, or slower and less severe compared to Italy. And that will depend a lot on what we do in the coming weeks.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is a lesson to be learned from looking at other parts of the world that are being affected in different ways like that. But that also brings us to the idea of thinking exponentially. You know, you drove this point home to me on the telephone recently, Thomas, that, you know, many people are looking at this additionally. And we have to try and understand, how is it that in many locations where these outbreaks of this virus strain have occurred, we have the seeming appearance of, oh, you know, steady growth, then overnight there's an explosion. Whoa, what happened? This is the exponential factor. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah. And this is one of the most tricky aspects of getting your head around an outbreak like this, Micah. You know, we're used to living in a world in which things add together. The change happens on what we call a linear scale, where 1 + 2 = 3 + 4 gives us a sense that we understand how change works. But by virtue of its very nature, epidemics don't happen in a world of addition. So welcome to the world of multiplication, of what we call exponential change. And, you know, I've been using this sort of simple analogy, Micah, to help sort of people understand this idea a little bit. And if I could just take a moment and spin this out for you a little bit. But imagine that you have a pond there in the backyard at the bunker, and it's a 10-foot pond in diameter. And you like going out there with your coffee every day and sitting there and watching the fish float around in your pond and watching the plants grow. And one day, for whatever reason, a dollop of some sort of algae lands on your pond. Let's say that dollop of algae is the size of a quarter. And let's say that algae, once it gets on top of your pond, that quarter-sized dollop of algae is going to double every day. And if you can imagine this as a kind of thought experiment, this will give some insight as to why this feeling of epidemics and how they explode takes place. So if I tell you, for example, that if this quarter-size deposition of algae on your pond doubles every day, that your pond will be totally covered by algae in 15 days. Now, think about this for a second. If I told you that this was what was going on in your pond, what would you guess is the percentage of the pond that is covered halfway through those 15 days, say at day 7?
You're not going to have a very significant amount, probably. Maybe 10%, 15%?
Yeah, that's what you would think. It turns out it's on day 7 you have 1%.
Wow.
On day 12 you have on day 12 the pond is only 12% covered. So if I tell you that the pond is completely covered on day 15, how covered is it on day 14?
Yeah, my math's better here. It's roughly half, right?
Half, right.
Yeah,
that's day 13, saying. It's a quarter. So it's not until the second to last day that the pond is half covered. Now, it's very difficult for our minds to get around that kind of change, the process of things doubling in time. The moral of the story is that if, you know, many of us, when we're sitting there drinking our coffee and looking at the pond, we're not alarmed. We're not concerned on days 1 through 6 through 8. By day 8, only 1% of the, we can barely notice the algae. Now, it turns out that's the moment in which we have the greatest chance of actually stopping the outbreak of algae before it takes over our pond. By day 13, it's too late. But the pond at that point is only 25% covered. So and by the way, the same thing happens with regard to, you know, why is it that our, you know, one day we go to the store and the shelves are full of toilet paper, and then boom, suddenly all the toilet paper is gone.
Yeah.
So that same exponential process of change is happening in many different ways during an epidemic, including how things fly off the shelves.
Yeah. You know, since you mentioned that, and I want to come back around here in a moment to flattening the curve. In other words, what can we do to flatten that curve? What does that mean for those who are unfamiliar with that term? And also, why is it important that we engage in this other new term we're hearing all about, social distancing? Because according to your own analysis, it seems to be effective. Let's get around to that in a moment. I first do want to ask you about panic buying. I addressed this last week on the show. I said, this is crazy. And you had actually said, well, no, it's not crazy, but Mike, it's also not panic-induced behavior. Why is that the case?
Yeah, so people tend to use the word panic. You know, as a social scientist, I want to have things clearly and carefully defined.
Right.
And, you know, emergency planners, you know, are very always worried that the public is going to panic. There's panic about panic that happens in emergency situations. So as a social scientist, I would define panic as irrational flight behavior. Okay. It's what happens if a fire breaks out in a factory and the doors are locked and no one can escape. That's when you get panic. Panic occurs in football stadiums when people are moving and crushing towards a locked gate. Then you get panic. In most disaster situations, panic is actually quite rare. People tend to cooperate and work collectively to solve common problems. Now, but the reality is that when things disappear like toilet paper off the shelf, we tend to label it panic buying, but it's actually a very it's something that it's the kind of behavior that we expect to see in times of emergency. We see certain things fly off the shelves every time there's a hurricane, and it's really a kind of pretty simple process where you're in the store and you're walking along, you came in there to buy some eggs or whatever it is, and suddenly you see somebody else who's got, you know, two dozen rolls of toilet paper in their basket, and you say, well, you know, you've been hearing stories of this epidemic that's coming out. You see other people buying large amounts, and it's a kind of FOMO situation, fear of missing out. You worry that seeing other people buying large quantities of certain items causes you to think, if I wait, then there will be none left when I need it. And that dynamic is another one of these exponential processes that happens in emergency situations. So on the one hand, we could say, yeah, we all wish we could live in a world in which officials advise us not to buy more than we need, but we don't live in that world. We live in a world where people do what they're going to do. And when they sense that there's a chance that things will run out, they have this stock up mentality that causes them to go out and buy perhaps more than they need. I don't call that panic. I call that managing uncertainty in times of change.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. You know, and again, when I mentioned it last week, I always try to think in terms of communities. And, you know, the more that people relax and that they kind of pace themselves, the more likely that there will be enough to go around. The other side of this, and I think especially from the medical perspective, is that the concern is that as more people become infected, maybe as concerning or more concerning than the effects of the illness itself is the idea that medical facilities and resources and personnel will be overwhelmed. And that's the kind of thing we absolutely want to try and avoid, because there will be an issue of resources if it gets to that point. Now, when we come back, I want to continue this conversation with Dr. Glass and look a little more at flattening the curve and the role that we all play in this pandemic situation. It is the Micah Hanks Program. We will be back right after this. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program, a very important episode tonight. And again, I want to try and get as much information out there in one fell swoop as we can. We will return to your regularly scheduled program again next week, but when breaking news happens, as I've often said, it's important to get that out there. We have the ideal guest joining us tonight to help us do that, Dr. Thomas Glass, PhD. Again, his website is simply Thomas Glass, PhD, all one word, .com. He's doing a daily briefing on this situation, which I guarantee you will find very helpful. And that brings us to the idea of this expression, flattening the curve, you know, referring to spreading out the number of infections, really with mindfulness for the fact that many of us, if not most, will eventually become infected. I think you said, according to the current figures, maybe as little as 40%, maybe as much as 80%. The idea is a lot of people will be infected. A lot of people are not going to be, you know, put into a position where their health is greatly at risk. But when we want to try and spread the number of infections so that hospitals aren't overwhelmed, you know, this is what flattening the curve means. Let's talk a little about the effectiveness of this strategy. And by the way, I'll mention for folks at home, since we've already talked about Dr. Glass's website, thomasglassphd.com has for the Sunday briefing, which just went out over the weekend, a graph that actually presents some of the data as you've been analyzing it with relation to the effectiveness of this strategy. So I already have an idea of how effective this may be. Let's talk about that. Is it effective? Can we expect this to last for a while? Why is it important to engage in this social distancing? And how does that help flattening the curve?
Sure. All good questions, Micah. So many of you probably heard the expression, it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it turns out it takes a village, a community, an entire society to defeat an infectious pathogen. And so one of the things to keep in mind is, like, when we talk about social distancing and flattening the curve, we're talking about how we as a society sort of band together and respond collectively in ways that are not necessarily designed to keep us as individuals from suffering negative consequences, but we're engaging in collective activity that is intended to protect those that are vulnerable. We know that this disease has a very high cost in terms of its impact on people who are older, over the age of 60, people who are dealing with chronic health problems like diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, and asthma, and other lung diseases. Those folks are at very high risk of being hospitalized and indeed dying. So if we work collectively, we have the opportunity to really do things that will make a big difference in terms of the ability of the healthcare system to respond effectively. So flattening the curve is the idea that once we have decided it's going to be impossible to contain the epidemic from doing what it wants to do, and that's essentially where we are with COVID-19. Once we've come to the point of recognizing that we have to manage the consequences as best we can, then the emphasis shifts not on stopping the epidemic per se, but in slowing it down so that new cases are emerging more over a longer period of time, which keeps us below a threshold at which point our healthcare system breaks down under stress. And, you know, if you look at the history of epidemics, including the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, one of the reasons it was so devastating is that a very high percentage of the hospital workers, doctors, nurses, were sick and unable to perform their duties. The hospitals ended up being overwhelmed, couldn't take care of people with any degree of standard of care, and the mortality numbers escalated as a result. So our focus now is on trying to allow to slow the epidemic in a way that allows our healthcare infrastructure to keep up with the burden of cases as they mount and grow. And so social distancing is a key part of that strategy. If we can minimize or reduce the number of secondary cases that that happen as a result of each new case, in other words, the number of people that each person who becomes infected transmits the disease to, if we can lower that number even slightly, we're able to slow the pace of the epidemic. This doesn't mean that we're going to reduce the total number of infections. It means we're going to spread them out over a longer period of time, again, to give our healthcare system a chance to keep up. So even small changes, not going out, not having large gatherings, working from home, the rate at which a disease moves through a population is a function of the disease itself, but more importantly, the pattern of social mixing. How much contact do we have with each other? How close are we physically to each other? How much are we giving the virus a head start in terms of its ability to spread? These are key factors that are modulated by our basic everyday patterns of behavior. And social distancing allows us to slow the spread of the disease by reducing the number of people that each person who becomes infected transmits the disease to.
Right. You know, I think a lot of people, this is in itself a little sobering because we all want to try and stay healthy. No one wants to get sick. And the idea that, you know, this is going to be a novel virus, people are going to get sick. Many more probably are going to get sick than many thought when this was just making news here in the United States and it was still being seen as a foreign concern, not something that we need to worry about necessarily here stateside. I think a lot of people are going, wait, hold on, you mean a bunch of us are going to get sick and that we're not trying to not get sick? We're trying to hold off how long before many of us get sick and to try and spread this out so that hospitals don't get overwhelmed. That naturally seems probably scary to a lot of people. Maybe we should reiterate again, you know, again, a lot of people will show very mild symptoms or none at all, but we do need to be realistic about the fact that this is a virus. It is spreading throughout the population. It is growing at a steady rate, you know, by many measures, and also an alarming rate. But also we need to keep in mind that as this process is underway, we can all play our part, and even those of us who are probably not going to be very adversely affected by it need to be mindful of the reasons for the quote-unquote social distancing, how that affects flattening the curve, why that is so important, and you have pointed out at your website again that it appears to be effective right now.
Yeah, right now we're sort of, people are trying different things in different places, and when governments and communities try different things to slow the rate of the infection or the epidemic, those become natural experiments that allow us to sort of study exactly what works and what doesn't. And we're still early in the process, so that we don't have really good answers to the question of what works and what doesn't. But at least in one really noteworthy case, I saw and put on my website some work that was done that compared the rate at which new cases arise in two parts of Italy, one of which adopted social distancing very early, and the other waited until the entire country was put into lockdown. And what you can see in the data presented in that article is a pretty clear pattern where the province in Italy that was that adopted social distancing early had a much slower rate at which the epidemic proceeded. So the evidence is not unanimous. There are some places where we've seen schools closed, gatherings prohibited, where it doesn't look as though it's slowed the epidemic down very much. But other places, it seems to be working better. So we're still in a place where, you know, the best tools that we have are not medical tools per se. They're social and behavioral tools for dealing with this epidemic. And there's still, I think, very solid reason to believe that these social distancing measures can and will be effective.
Yeah. Before we kind of wind down here also, and I just want to thank you for taking so much time to discuss this, because this is also important. And, you know, there's also that side of me, I guess, the scientifically minded side, that's very interested in all of this. I find this all very interesting. It's going to be an instance where our interest in a topic like this also has practical benefits. But I want to talk a little here with you about the length of the pandemic, the expected length. Many are saying, look, you know, well, actually, let me put it to you like this. A lot of people, I think, are unrealistically expecting, you know, a couple of weeks and this is all going to blow over. And then we'll all be back out there on the beaches again. All of us will be out there, you know, going to coffee shops, drinking coffee and, you know, playing hockey, all the kinds of things we enjoy. But really, many experts I've seen, including yourself, are saying, don't expect in a couple of weeks that everything will be back to normal. This is probably going to last quite a while. Can we expect that weather may impact this? Why or why not? And really, in terms of the length of the pandemic, more broadly speaking, what can we really expect?
Yeah, of course, I wish I had a real perfect crystal ball on that, Mike. What I can tell you is that I hear plenty of people who say that we're overreacting. I hear people saying that this is going to be, this going to blow over in a couple of weeks. I generally think that I think we're pretty clear right now that this this pandemic is not going to be over in a couple of weeks, and that that the pandemic is going to play out such that you know, infection is going to be widespread in all corners of the globe. Because this is a novel organism that we don't yet have the ability to fight. Exactly how long the duration of the epidemic will be is hard to say. The numbers that I have been using are somewhere between 6 months and 18 months to 2 years. This first wave of the epidemic as it moves across the planet is going to be worse than it will be in subsequent years once we have a vaccine. But the vaccine, in truth, is probably a year away, a year to 18 months away from really being able to make a big difference. Now, the seasonality question is a tricky one. If you know, a lot of people initially believed that the epidemic was going to disappear when things got warm. Well, that flies in the face of what we already know, because the epidemic is we have had outbreaks in places that have been warm and are already quite warm. In fact, in the last couple of days, the states that have the most, the highest rates of new cases are southern states, where it is already pretty warm. The truth is that seasonal effects tend to show up after a new disease has worked its way through the population at least once. In 1918 and in other epidemics, we're expecting to some extent some waning in the summer months, but that may be followed by additional waves of infectious outbreak that occur in the fall and winter of next year. So this is going to take some time, but listen, we are going to get through this. This is not Armageddon. This is not the apocalypse.
Right.
We will get through this and things will go back to normal, but we should expect continued disruption of many aspects of life for a period somewhere between 6 months and 18 months.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, just that's kind of a good place maybe to kind of wind things down, because again, it is not Armageddon. You know, in my, I did a column last week, in fact, where I had said this was not the zombie apocalypse. I do think that there is a, well, you know, many of us in our enjoyment of films and entertainment that involves these apocalyptic kind of, you know, scenarios that has, in a way, I think, sort of conditioned us. I know it's been like that for me, and it's important to be able to be prepared for the worst case scenario, but I think a lot of people are actually reacting to this. There are the two reactions, those who just don't seem to think this is really serious at all, and then those who are like, okay, it is The Walking Dead, time to bunker down. I don't think we're to that point yet, and so it's always good to be prepared for the worst, but to be realistic about things, and to recognize that, again, this is not Armageddon. It is not the end of the world. We have a lot to be thankful for, and if we are able to work together, we have a good chance. In fact, we will inevitably get through this.
Oh, you bet. I mean, those who think that this is, you know, been overhyped, or it's that a media, you know, conspiracy or something, you know, I think those people are just wrong. And at the same time, people who think that it's hopeless and that it's Armageddon and there's nothing that can be done, those people are wrong too. The truth is that we've got more tools for dealing with an epidemic like this than we've ever had before. We are, for example, able to really carefully genetically sequence and monitor changes in the virus as the epidemic progresses. We've never had that ability before. We've got social media and other ways of communicating about what's going on that are allowing us to be more resourceful and creative in the ways that we respond. So there's a lot of things on the plus side in terms of our ability to manage this, but people do need to be clear-minded and fact-driven about the reality of the situation, and that is that we are faced with one of those challenges that comes along. Listen, there's nothing unexpected about what's happening. This is not mysterious. This is what nature does. It throws viral diseases at us. It has been doing that for the entire span of human history. So you know, humans adapt and respond. We're this is what we do, and we'll figure it out. I'm confident of that. But it's going to be a bumpy ride for a while, Micah. That's just the bottom line. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
Yes, it is. And so while so many of us are stuck indoors, and we can't go out, and we can't do a lot of the things that we normally enjoy, I mean, you know, again, we should be thankful for technology, for the ability to stay in touch, for the ability to communicate like this and to be able to hear from experts like you, Dr. Glass. And I also want to emphasize, he has a good UFO story, a personal one, which I hope to talk with him about for subscribers, because, you know, all this information, I'm not going to inundate my listenership every week with COVID-19, although there will be updates. This week, I thought it was really important to get a lot on the table, and of course, all of that available freely to the public. Now, Dr. Glass has agreed to share his own UFO experience and talk a little bit about how social science can be applied to that subject for ex-subscribers. But we will wrap up this conversation about the coronavirus pandemic with our special guest when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Broadcasting from an undisclosed bunker location, deep below the Appalachian Mountains. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. And even as we are concluding this week's show, Lauren has just sent me an update here. And the county in which I reside has seen 4 new cases of the coronavirus. There were 3 that picked up over the weekend. So we have seen that number double, very much like the exponential growth Dr. Glass has already pointed out. Now, again, most who contract this virus, if it's even noticeable, it will be mild. That's true. But again, in terms of flattening the curve, we have to do our part. And even though the reality is that most people who are affected will not suffer severe effects, nonetheless, we have to try and slow the spread. And in an effort to do that, Dr. Glass, I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the pages that you have at your site devoted to preparedness and prevention. At your website, you've got 3 separate pages, which maybe we will touch on briefly here. A recommended step-by-step preparation method. You've got also the top 10 everyday precautions to reduce risk of infection, and then your household go kit. All those can be found at your website, thomasglass.com, where he gives daily briefings and he's keeping all that information coming. But really quickly, let's maybe go over a quick preparation and also precautions to reduce the risk of infection.
Yeah, well, the main thing to consider, let me talk about one thing first, Micah.
Sure.
Masks. You see people wearing masks out in public. Is this a good idea or is it not a good idea? The reason this is such an important thing to focus on masks is because there are no masks. We've run out of them. Well, that's not entirely true. There are stockpiles of masks that are being managed as we speak. But the use of masks is a tricky thing. Sometimes we imagine that COVID-19 is a disease that floats in the air, an airborne pathogen that we can breathe in. And I understand how people imagine that. And that is true for highly contagious diseases, most notably measles. But this disease does not actually work that way. The COVID-19, like most coronaviruses, is spread by respiratory droplets that land on surfaces. We touch those surfaces with our hands. We touch our face, our nose, our eyes. Those respiratory droplets are transferred to our face, and the virus enters our various openings. So the main thing that happens is a cough, a sneeze, respiratory droplets land on a surface. We touch the surface. We touch our face. People wear a mask, and most masks are not effective at actually blocking airborne the virus in airborne form, and they actually can do more harm than good for people who are not infected, because we end up doing what? We touch our face more when we're wearing a mask. So we can actually increase our likelihood of getting sick by wearing masks. Masks should be used by people who are healthcare providers, who are actually working with and treating patients who are infected, and or people should wear masks if they are actually sick and must go out, particularly going to the doctor. And by the way, if you are sick and you have a presumptive case of COVID-19, don't go out because you could give the disease to others.
Right.
The only time to go out is to go to the doctor's office. And also, don't run to the emergency room. Okay, if you're sick, don't run to the emergency room. Don't run to the hospital. Call your doctor and get advice. It may be possible to just manage your illness at home. But back to masks. The people who should be wearing masks are those who are already sick, or people who are healthcare workers that are taking care of the sick. And it's critical that we understand this, because if ordinary citizens buy up all the masks, then we're seeing what we're actually seeing now all over the country, which is that hospitals and physicians and nurses and respiratory therapists and all the people who really need the masks don't have access to them, and there are supply chain problems from getting the masks, because guess what? Those masks are all made in China.
Yeah.
We need to be very careful about not using masks for in the wrong way and for the wrong reason. The main takeaway of this part of our discussion is that people need to wash their hands, because, as I said, droplets land on surfaces from a cough or a sneeze. We touch the surface, we touch our face, bam, the virus is off and running. So stopping that intermediate transfer of the virus from surfaces to our body is critical, and we do that by washing our hands. Sing happy birthday for 20 seconds while you wash your hands. Ordinary soap and water is fine, works well. This virus is a little bit wimpy when it comes to exposure to alcohol or soap. It dies readily. However, it does live on surfaces for half a day all the way up until a couple of days, depending on the surfaces. So clean and disinfect the surfaces in your house. I have a little sign that hangs on my refrigerator, and members of my family, we take turns going around and using a disinfecting wipe to wipe down surfaces in the house twice a day. Tabletops, light switches, handrails, doorknobs. I put little star stickers on these things in my house to remind us. And twice a day, somebody in the family takes a disinfecting wipe and goes around the house and cleans those surfaces. The virus can live on the surface, as I say, depending on what the surface is and other factors, up to 2 days. So cleaning the virus from your home. And if someone in your home becomes sick, it's critical that you try to separate them and engage in what's called self-isolation within your home. That means keep the bathroom separate, keep their eating utensils separate, keep towels and sheets separate. Try to minimize contact within your home between the sick person and others. Leave food at the door. Talk to them on Skype from a different room, and be reassuring and loving towards those that are sick, but try to minimize contact to the extent that you can. Those are just some of the simple things, strategies and tools. The things that I've developed on my website are things that I'm actually using in my house. Things like, rules, behavioral rules in the house that can be posted. We have a little game in our house where anytime anybody touches their face or forgets to wipe things down or forgets to use hand sanitizer coming in and out of the house, we call it the booger tax. We have a plastic jar in that, in the living room. And anytime somebody touches their face or breaks a rule, someone else yells, "You picked your nose, booger tax," and you have to put a quarter into the jar. It becomes kind of a fun game that keeps everybody accountable. So these are all just tools, kind of, and they're available for free on the website. Please distribute them as you can. Simple stuff matters: washing your hands, covering your mouth when you cough and sneeze with a sleeve or a cloth. Basic, simple things. That stuff is really important.
Yes. Absolutely. I cannot thank you enough, Thomas, for joining us and for talking about all this, for lending so much of your insight and your professional career. I mean, it speaks for itself how much you have learned, how much you're able to bring to this conversation. So again, I do want to implore people, please, to check out thomasglassphd.com. That is his website. You're going to find out that it is a very informative source for information as it is coming forward about this. And he is certainly an expert and someone who has a lot to provide and a lot to share about this. So thank you again. I'm sure I'll be in touch with you again in the weeks and months to follow with further updates as this is, as this situation is evolving and we're learning more. And I thank you again for being on here with me today.
You're most welcome. It's been my pleasure, and stay strange and safe out there.
We will. If these are strange times, might as well stay safe in them. Thank you again to Dr. Thomas Glass for being our guest, and he has promised me a good UFO story. for X subscribers. No more coronavirus talk for now. But that will be the final word for this week's edition of the show. This show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control in Ogden, Utah are Race Hobbs and Warren Breger. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks. And other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. As always, I am Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange, safe, and healthy out there.